I can feel this cold grip tightening with each passing day. We can see the weaponization of fear and loathing, the decimation of international law. We are returning to a pre-1945 world.
The great horrible shock of this decade has been that actually autocracy has been crowding out democracy in all types of ways that we haven't really fully digested.
Yanis Varoufakis, Gillian Tett, hello to you both. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be with you.
Now, earlier this year, the former head of MI6, Sir Alex Younger, told us on Newsnight that we have entered a new era of international relations driven mainly by Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. I wanted to ask you both, Yanis, is he right? And if he is, what are the consequences of that?
I tend to take a view that somebody like Trump, however significant he might be, and he's significant, is no more than a symptom of a creeping authoritarianism that has been in the ascendancy since at least the great financial collapse of 2008, our generation's 1929. And this authoritarianism, you know, reflecting back on the years, and particularly in 2025, speaking personally, it is as if it's filling the air, leaving a metallic taste that clings on the back of the throat, the way that Trumpism is in cahoots with a rabid misogynist manosphere, not just in the United States, but in Europe and elsewhere. I can feel this cold grip tightening with each passing day. We can see the weaponization of fear and loathing, the decimation of international law. We are returning to a pre-1945 world in which, to quote Thucydides, the weak suffer what they must. And it seems to most young people that the future is not what it used to be.
Right. Is Donald Trump not simply doing, I'll come to you in a moment, Gillian, but Yanis, is Donald Trump not simply simply doing what he promised to do in the run-up to the US presidential election, which he won pretty much overwhelmingly?
No, absolutely. He's got a mandate to do what he's doing. This is a tragedy. But that doesn't stop this parallelism, which I feel in my bones, between what the strongmen of the mid-war period in the 1920s were doing. They never hid their ill intent, and still they gathered power and support amongst the populations that had lost hope. So this hopelessness that had begun in earnest in 2008 with our generation's 1929, the failures of the center-left, the failures of the left, including myself, has paved the ground for these people to advocate for misanthropy and win elections.
Gillian Tett, is Sir Alex Younger right? What do you think?
I think he's absolutely right, and I would agree with Yanis in that the way I'd put it is we are indeed looking at a gigantic back-to-the-future moment, back to the 1930s in many ways, and there are three defining elements of what...
Sorry, when you say back to the 1930s in many ways, that is a big statement to make. What do you mean specifically?
What I mean by that is really two particular things. Firstly, we're seeing the rise of what I call the three P's, populism, protectionism, and extreme patriotism, otherwise known as nationalism, which is what we saw after 1929. And we're seeing all three of those elements appearing not just in America right now, but also in parts of Europe. Secondly, though, and one of the biggest and most jarring shifts of this year has been an explosion of what might be called geoeconomics and hegemonic power, dominant power politics. Albert Hirschman, an economist, wrote a brilliant book about it just after World War II, analyzing that interwar period, when he talked about the incredible importance of hegemonic power politics. Big dominant countries using economic tools like trade policy, not so much just to promote their economies, but actually as a tool of political power games. And this bundling together of politics, economics, trade, military, cultural, tech issues, all into one gigantic transactional game where you're putting chips on the table to bargain with each other and threaten each other, that is a hallmark of what the Trump administration has brought into geopolitics this year. I suspect it will continue next year, and that was absolutely what we saw in the 1930s and which the post-World War II era tried to move away from.
Yanis, haven't Donald Trump's interventions on foreign policy been successful.
Well, not just successful, triumphant from his perspective. But allow me to cast a more broad gaze upon 2025 and do it in terms of what I consider to be three momentous events, global events, mm-hmm. Where Donald Trump was a key player, maybe the key player. The first upset or, you know, momentous event is Russia's victory in Ukraine, not so much against the Ukrainians, but against Europe's leaders. Because for almost 4 years now, the European Union and NATO have been engaging in a perilous double game. They committed rhetorically to a Ukrainian victory, which were materially unwilling to bankroll. And now we have a decisive Russian victory, which of course was mitigated, was propagated to a large extent by Donald Trump. The second momentous event...
I'm going to pause you if I may. I mean, we have not got a peace agreement, a peace proposal. You're describing Russia as having been triumphant in Ukraine, though.
It has been triumphant over the Europeans. The Europeans have no strategy for war. They are not prepared to bankroll a war that they prefer to this kind of peace that Putin and Trump are engineering, and they have no plan for peace either. So that is a decisive victory by Putin, and with Trump helps, over the European leadership, the European Union and NATO. This is my assessment. But there are two other dimensions or upsets that supplement this, and Donald Trump is central to that. The second one is that I think, maybe you will find this also controversial, China has won the trade war against the United States. First by weaponizing its dominance over rare earths, and then defeating the chip embargo through the mobilization of its technological machinery. And the third upset, which completes this trifecta in which Donald Trump is central, is Donald Trump's victory against the Europeans when it comes to the tariff war. You know, remember the scene where Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, is being humiliated in Donald Trump's golf course in Scotland, effectively committing herself to things that she can't deliver, like $700 billion of investments from Europe to the United States, and a complete collapse of the European position on tariffs. If you take these three victories by Putin, Trump, and President Xi of China, then I think you begin to see my point of view that 2025 is going to stay in history as a very pivotal year, where the old global order has been well and truly torn asunder.
Yeah. I want to come back to tariffs a little later, if I may. Yeah. Gillian, your assessment, though, of Donald Trump's foreign policy across 2025?
Well, I would echo
what Yanis has said to some degree. Two points I'd make, though, is... Anne Applebaum wrote an excellent book recently, The Commentator, pointing out that we all thought after the collapse of the Berlin Wall that essentially we were entering an era where democracy crowded out autocracy, in the sense that gradually the Western democratic countries would convert the rest of the world to the way of operating. And in fact, the great horrible shock of this decade has been that actually autocracy has been crowding out democracy in all types of ways that we haven't really fully digested. And the reality is we're entering a period of time when, if you accept this concept of hegemonic power politics, and hegemonic power politics is a posh word for dominant global power politics, essentially China has hegemonic power, global dominance, but by virtue of the manufacturing systems it controls, because it has all kinds of sway over key choke points over things like rare earth minerals. America has hegemonic power because the dollar is reserve currency, and essentially it makes America dominant in global finance. Each side is trying to undermine the other's hegemonic power right now. And tech hegemony, in my view, i.e. digital hegemony, is still being contested between the two. And when you look at the world in that framing, you realize what's really going on here, which is China and America are battling for control. Russia, in some ways, is a side player, although parts of the American establishment seem minded to cede European affairs partly to Russia, partly to the EU, in a kind of battle between them. But it puts countries like the UK and EU in a very weak position because it really is about hegemonic power, and the UK and Europe doesn't really have that right now.
Before we move on to talk further about tariffs and economies, I just want to ask you, Yanis, you talked about masculinity at the beginning of this conversation, and you believe that that is driving a lot of policy on the international stage. Why do you think that is?
I will go back to what Gillian said before, the comparison of our era with that of the 1930s, because masculinity was part and parcel of the rise of fascism in the 1920s and 1930s. Think of Mussolini, think of Hitler, think of the idea that the body politic was somehow infected by impurities that had to be cleansed. And part of those impurities had to do with women entering the workforce, not staying at home, a rabid misogyny. One Donald Trump is saying, I'm going to make you great again as long as you hand over to me your voice, as long as you forget about having your own voice, as long as essentially you empower the great man in order to do two things. Firstly, to project power, masculine power internationally, and secondly, to cleanse the body politic of the United States from trans people, from feminism, from everything that has stopped America from being great in his own deluded mind. You know, America was once great and he's going to make it great again. But this is, you know, the proto-fascism of the 1930s. You can hear it in the language of Viktor Orban in Hungary. You can hear it in the language of Le Pen, of Jean Bardelais in France. You know, there is a pattern here, and I think it really is. Maybe you will accuse me of being an economist and of being economically in my thinking. But, you know, it all begins with Wall Street collapsing and then austerity for the many, creating discontent, the left failing to harness this discontent into a humanist project, and then the right comes with this combination of misogyny, the manosphere, and authoritarianism to take over. Of course, the moment they take over, they start betraying even the working class men that have lured into their alliance.
Right.
But then it's too late.
Yanis, is it a failure of the left to keep calling Donald Trump a fascist? Doesn't that cement his support with those who voted for him?
Well, you know, calling a spade is always important. The problem with Trump is that he doesn't fit in exactly the fascist mold of the 1930s. I call him a proto-fascist, but I never insult, unlike Hillary Clinton, who called his base deplorables, I never believe that we of the left have the right to surrender all those people to fascism. My duty, as I see it, is to connect with them.
Okay.
Now, is this impeded by calling their leader a fascist? Maybe, but then a spade needs to be called a spade.
Gillian, do you come in?
I was going to say, I'm very glad that Yanis raised a point about the obsessive use of masculinity as a kind of meme to project power on the part of the Trumpians and others. Because it's much easier for a man to say that and be taken seriously rather than women at the moment. I mean, Yanis has written a book about all the women in his family who've been very strong influences on his own life. But I really would urge all the men who are horrified by this trend to stand up and call it out for what it is, which is at best an emphasis on masculinity, at worst sometimes outright misogyny. And there are many aspects of this. I mean, there's a real focus on competition and aggression rather than empathy. There's a real focus on winner-take-all. There's a real focus on strength and purity and all of these memes, which again hark back to the 1930s. And this is something which is deeply disturbing, if not depressing, for anyone who fought for progress and more inclusion in the last few decades.
Okay. Donald Trump would say progress involved his tariff policy. I want to ask you, Gillian, has the U.S. tariff policy this year been a success for the American people?
Well, it's been a success in the sense that it's changed the conversation around tariffs globally and what economists call the Overton window, the framework of possible policy debate, has radically shifted. So that now tariffs are absolutely on the agenda, and it's forced other countries, like the European Union, to start thinking about retaliation or ways of defending themselves by essentially adopting, if you can't beat them, join them, approach to these policy making. So from that point of view, President Trump's tariffs have indeed changed the conversation. They've also raised quite a lot of revenue as a kind of stealth tax, which has helped reduce the deficit. And thus far, they've managed to not crater the economy, contrary to a lot of predictions from people. And while inflation is well above the Fed's target, partly because of the tariffs, in my view, inflation hasn't gone completely berserk either. However, what the tariffs have not done is force capitulation for countries like China. On the contrary, China's won a number of victories against America. And it certainly hasn't bolstered confidence in the American economy. On the contrary, you can see consumer confidence and business confidence really wobbling quite starkly. Inflation has crept up. And the other really important thing is it's not even clear whether tariffs are going to actually remain in place, because, of course, we have all manner of legal challenges against the tariffs right now. So at the beginning of 2026, it's possible that Trump may end up with a slightly black mark over the tariff policy because some of them are actually turned down or actually negated by his own Supreme Court.
We've seen potentially Zoran Mandai, his election in New York, a hugely popular figure on the left, concentrate on the cost of living, on rent controls, bus fares and so on. Is this what the Democratic Party should now be channeling?
The short answer is absolutely yes. The Mamdani victory shows how that appeals to voters. And frankly, the fact that President Trump essentially had this massive detente with Mamdani, having earlier criticized him in the White House, shows that he himself doesn't just like a winner, he always does, President Trump, but he also recognizes that the cost of living issue resonates with voters and he wants to get on the right side of that. But to my mind, the more interesting question for 2026 is this. We have seen during the last year growing cracks emerging between the nationalist populist part of the MAGA base, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Steve Bannon and others, and what might be called the broligarchs, the tech oligarchs, the elites that Trump has surrounded himself with. And many of his policies thus far, as indeed Yanis says, have very much favored the broligarchs. The people around him are powerful, rich, and often linked to the AI and tech sector. But you can see growing frustration and anger on the part of the nationalist populists who propelled him into power via MAGA in comments like from Steve Bannon attacking some of the tech oligarchs, attacking some of the policies like the H-1B visas which let skilled immigrants in. You can see growing frustration from people like Marjorie Taylor Greene against what Trump is doing. So to my mind, the interesting fissure in 2026 is not just the Democrats-Republican one and whether the Democrats can find a good leader to actually challenge the Trumpians. It's really about whether the Trump alliance can hold together as smoothly as it has in 2025 or not. And cost of living is absolutely central to that, because the people it's hitting are the national populists, not the broligarchs.
Yanis, can I ask you for your assessment of Zoran Mamdani? Thus far, obviously, it's early days.
Well, full disclosure, I have supported him years before you knew who he was. So, you know, I'm a totally biased commentator here. I think he did brilliantly. The difficulty now is to implement the three or four policies. This was what was very smart about his campaign. He just concentrated on three or four things, which, you know, have a capacity of being measurable outcomes. The problem that that the Democrats have, similar to the problems that the Republicans have, as Gillian put it, I mean, the Republicans are divided. The MAGA base is split, exactly as Gillian said, between two different constituencies that are very much at odds with one another. There is almost a class war between the MAGA base that supports Steve Bannon and the populists, and the tech lords. But similarly, the Democratic Party, judging by what the Democratic Party establishment did in 2016, it's clear that they would much rather see Donald Trump win the election than let somebody like Bernie Sanders in. And similarly, I very much fear that they would still budge at the idea of supporting somebody like Mamdani to go head-to-head with Trump. I think that somebody like Mamdani could give the Democrats the oomph that they need to get out of the mire in which they found themselves last year, but I very much doubt it that the Democratic Party wants it.
Okay, so there's...
Or rather, another way of putting it would be to say that there are basically four parties now in America trying to jostle to be fitting themselves into a two-party system. And unsurprisingly, that is not an easy political mix. It's actually quite explosive.
Is there anything, Yanis, the left in Europe, could, and I'm including the UK in that, of course, could learn from the new left rising up in the United States?
There are always lessons to learn from all over the world. But in particular, I'll just pick one. Mm-hmm. The importance of having a very clear campaigning manifesto for what we would do tomorrow morning, if we had our hands on the levers of power. And then link this with what we would do in 12 months, in 48 months, in 5 years, in 10 years. This is what the left lacks. We are very good at great speeches about human rights and about, fighting exploitation and emancipation and so on. Not fighting emancipation, but emancipating people.
Yep.
We're not very good at being very specific and laser focused on the three things, like Mamdani succeeded in doing, that we would do tomorrow morning, as a precursor to a societal change.
Okay, that is interesting. And how do you think, Gillian, the UK politicians in particular should respond to the success of those on the right? And I'm thinking about, obviously, Reform UK.
Well, I would echo what Yana says about European politicians and say that for the left right now, there's two or three key principles they need to learn. Firstly, they need to recognize we are in a populist age, and they may not want to pander to populism entirely, because the problem with populism is you can't talk about trade-offs, but they need to think about populist communication and how they actually break through, as Mamdani has done so well. Secondly, they need to remember the KISS mantra, keep it simple, stupid. And that has been, in many ways, one of the biggest problems with what Rachel Reeves has done in terms of the economic policy making, because it's so complex, people can't really work out whether they're winning or losing or what the kind of overarching framework is.
For those watching around the world on this, by the way, just to say Rachel Reeves is the UK Chancellor, so the UK's Finance Minister.
Absolutely. So I'll give you one example. I personally think that if Rachel Reeves, as the incoming Finance Minister, Chancellor, when she got into power last year, had said up front, we're going to have to break our manifesto pledge and actually put one or two pence on income tax rates. But that's our simple framework for trying to deal with the deficit and the fiscal hole. That would have been a lot more palatable to people than trying to do death by a thousand cuts and lots of little complicated measures all over the place, which alienated lots of different interest groups, pitted them against each other, and created a sense of confusion about what was really happening or not happening, and really did undermine people's desire for clarity and a sense of excitement and growth. And that leads me on to my third point, is that the left has to start talking about growth and opportunity and entrepreneurship and businesses being good, not just bad in their eyes, and actually do things to raise animal spirits, to quote John Maynard Keynes, the economist, who talked about this need for actually having something that lifts public mood and optimism and confidence in the future. Because without that, it's very hard to grow. And without more confidence in the future and growth, you won't actually have a pie to distribute in the first place.
I just want to pick you up on your suggestion that Rachel Reeves should have broken the manifesto promise months after promising, pledging they would not raise income tax. You say that would have been better than what they have ended up doing. You will know from the Liberal Democrats, between 2010 and 2015, they were in coalition government with the Conservatives. They broke their manifesto promise of on tuition fees. They said they would scrap tuition fees. That didn't happen. And they were decimated in the 2015 general election. So electorally, they paid for breaking that promise.
Absolutely. But the reality is that, first of all, it's a stupid pledge to have given on the campaign trail.
But they did.
They did it, yeah. Labour came in on a landslide, and I personally think they could have weathered that. And they could have done it, weathered that, if it had basically been a one-off measure to try and set Britain on a better fiscal path, to calm the bond markets down, and then going hand-in-hand with a package of measures to actually unleash growth. Because what they needed to do was persuade employers to hire more people rather than tax measures they introduced, which actually discourage employers from hiring people. They needed to, you know, incentivize entrepreneurship, business creation. They needed to bring wealth creators to Britain and actually get the economy moving and a sense of optimism and excitement. And that didn't happen, and that's the tragedy.
Yanis, next year is the 10th anniversary of Brexit. There's been quite a bit of talk about the UK moving closer to Europe, and certainly we've seen what the Labour government has called resets with the EU since they came to power. Where could that lead, do you think, potentially in 2026?
Well, full disclosure to begin with, in 2015-16, I campaigned along with many people in Britain against Brexit. I'm saying this so the viewer knows where I'm coming from. Having said that, I think it would be suicidal now for Keir Starmer to reopen the Brexit question, primarily for one reason. Firstly, he doesn't have a mandate for it. He didn't campaign last time on this. Maybe he wants to put it forward for after the next general election, but that would be a mistake too, because the one claim to fame he has as an otherwise utterly unsuccessful prime minister is that he managed to secure a trade deal with Donald Trump, which is slightly better than that of the European Union. Mm-hmm. So he has to say, look, I'm going to trust this because I want to go back into the customs union, because you can't be in the customs union and have the preferential tariff rates that Trump has granted you, or he can't have his cake and eat it. And I think that, you know, to start this conversation now, when the European Union is in a state of serious disrepair, I was campaigning even after the Brexit referendum for Britain to, okay, you decided to get out of the European Union, but at least stay in the single market. You know what? I cannot put my hand on my heart and say something similar now, because the single market is kaput. It's finished. We have destroyed it in the European Union. Since the pandemic, the French and German governments have done everything they could in order to dismantle it. Now we have a single market only in name. And more generally, we have a massive investment deficit in Europe. We are shrinking. We're stagnating. Volkswagen cannot sell cars. So it is passing on production lines to Rheinmetall to produce tanks that not even the Ukrainians want. We are borrowing through the nose 800 billion to buy these weapons, these armaments that are not even up to scratch for our defensive purposes. So to start a conversation today in Britain about the, you know, reopening this very traumatic chapter of the European Union, given the state of disrepair of the European Union, and given his small success story in the trade deal with the United States, I think that would be suicide.
I want to come back to you on you describing Keir Starmer as otherwise an utterly unsuccessful Prime Minister in just a moment. But Gillian Tett, what do you think this government, the UK government, could do to, as you put it, change the mood, to release those animal spirits?
Well, I do agree that on the 10th anniversary of Brexit, it would be very hard politically for Keir Starmer to tie himself back again to the European Union, because the European Union does have a lot of problems. I'm of the camp that says the way to fix the problems in the European Union is to adopt what I call a drones plus Draghi strategy, which is to essentially implement all of the measures that Mario Draghi, the former head of the European Central Bank, suggested last year to make the European Union more competitive and more of a single market, but also to recognize they need to get serious about preparing for military defense and to use that as a way to stimulate the economy as well and focus on new technologies like drones. Right. But if the European Union doesn't do that, then I understand why the UK may not want to tie itself to the European Union that closely. But there are crucial things they could do right now without embracing a customs union that could be very beneficial, like youth mobility scheme. As someone who sits in Cambridge University, I can't stress strongly enough what an uplifting act that would be to actually make it easier for British students to go to Europe, to work there, to study there, and vice versa. They could focus on scientific partnerships, make it much easier for researchers and academics to go back and forth. That's critical if we're going to build our know-how economy in the UK and elsewhere. We need to have much closer union around military issues and actually trying to work together with the rest of the European Union to get cutting-edge military equipment together. So there's all kinds of things they could do right now to actually create closer ties without embracing the customs union. And I think that, again, would be a very positive act to create more optimism.
Yanis, you were pretty scathing about Keir Starmer as the UK Prime Minister. I suppose if he were here, he would point to raising the minimum wage, point to introducing free breakfast clubs for all primary school age children so they're never hungry when they go into the classroom. He would point to beginning to bring down the massive NHS waiting lists that we have here. He would point to taking 150 quid off people's energy bills, which is still high. That's from next April, and so on and so forth. Is that fair?
Well, I don't feel like kicking a man when he's down, and he's clearly down. You can, of course, come up with a catalogue of small victories and some improvements, which I do not want to belittle. But nevertheless, when it comes to the big picture, he has failed in macroeconomic terms. He and Rachel Reeves have completely lost the plot. They have no plan, no understanding, no analysis of what the fundamental issue of the United Kingdom economy is. You have a lot of money in the United Kingdom economy. You are a rich country. You have massive liquidity, and you are failing spectacularly to convert it into productive investments. And he's got no idea of how to do this. Rachel Reeves going to the City of London and trying to, you know, ingratiate herself with the people, with the bankers who are preventing this money from being used for good purpose is not going to help. On the question of migration, on the question of borders, on the question that empowers the racist forces which are pushing for Nigel Farage to move into 10 Downing Street, he has been a total moral failure. He has tried to counter this, the manosphere and the racism that is in the ascendancy with racism light through performative acts of punishing refugees, but not as much as, Nigel Farage would do it. When it comes to foreign policy, his shenanigans with Ukraine, I mean, this attempt constantly to go into bed with Emmanuel Macron and in a coalition of the willing when they are not prepared to put the money in, where their mouth is, when they have no plan for what they would recommend to Vladimir Putin if there is going to be a peace plan. And more generally, you can see from legislation that even Labour MPs have opposed, with the result that some of them were frozen out for a very long time, that, this is a Labour government that is far more interested in ingratiating itself to people that would never vote for it, and treat their own voters, especially the disabled and the needy, with a certain contempt that is coming back to bite them.
Okay, two things again. For fairness reasons, Nigel Farage would say he's not a racist. Keir Starmer would say he's been absolutely steadfast in supporting Ukraine and President Zelensky. And if it wasn't for interventions from people like Keir Starmer or Emmanuel Macron of France, then Donald Trump wouldn't still be here now, as precarious as it is, but wouldn't still be here now trying to get some sort of peace in Ukraine.
And I would say that no racist I've ever come across in my quite long life by now has ever admitted to being racist. As for Keir Starmer's assistance to Ukraine, in my estimation, it's precisely zero. The only reason why
The UK has given billions of pounds in military aid to Ukraine, as well as expertise from our own armed forces.
Militarily, yes, but in terms of getting to a place where Ukraine can be a sovereign country that can live in peace with its neighbors, the contribution of Britain, in the same way as the contribution of the European Union, has been a negative one. They have, for instance, They have prevented the peace process that started some time ago. They have obstructed it every bit of the way without having their own idea of what the peace process would be, except for demanding that Russia loses the war diplomatically when it is winning in the battlefields. Okay. They are not, you said that they're putting billions in it. How many billions? It is nothing. It's a drop in the ocean compared to the ambition of somebody like Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron to lead Ukraine to victory.
Okay, a final thought from both of you. Gillian Tett, what do you think could be the dominant theme of 2026?
I think, once again, geoeconomics, the idea that economic policy making is now just a tool of political power. And that's very different from what we had in the previous few decades, where essentially we were all raised to believe that economics was something that sat in a bucket that was different from politics or culture or military issues or tech policy. Now it's all jumbled up together. The European Union is gradually realizing that. The UK is understanding that as well when it comes to dealing with Donald Trump. But we are in an age of geoeconomics. The unfortunate thing about geoeconomic policy making is it tends to be contagious. If one country like China or America is adopting it, it's very hard for others to resist that. And therein lies the huge challenge for both the UK and the European Union in 2026.
And Yanis Varoufakis, what would you say could be the dominant theme of next year?
Well, I think that the event in April when President Xi and President Trump are going to meet again to extend their temporary agreement, I think that will be the pivotal event of the year. But allow me, I need to make a comment to Gillian that, you know, I spent my last few decades teaching students of economics that if you try to take the politics out of economics, you end up with both very bad economics and toxic politics. So, you know, this geopolitical, geoeconomic merging of political, cultural, and economic realities is essential for us to keep in mind, because if we don't, we end up with really bad politics and really bad economics.
Is that fair from your point of view, Gillian?
I would agree. I mean, one of the ironies, people used to talk about companies having to pay attention to stakeholders when it came to environmental, social, and governance goals. Now that so-called ESG complex is very much being beaten back by the Trump administration. But that doesn't mean that stakeholderism is dead or that companies can go back to just caring about shareholders. In this new paradigm, they're having to worry about different types of stakeholders, like national security interests and right-wing cultural values and populism. And that's kind of scary. However, if the left is going to form a coherent riposte to the right now, they need to embrace stakeholderism in a kind of more positive way and talk about things like cost of living and societies, but also recognize the importance of national security interests as well. Because like it or not, that I think is a dominant theme of a world which is increasingly fractious and polarized and frankly, increasingly dangerous too.
Gillian Tett, Yanis Varoufakis, thank you both very much for talking to Newsnight.
Thank you.
Thank you.